Welcome to Sober.Coffee, a weekly coffee chat sharing experience, strength, and hope for anyone on the sober road to recovery. You can download Sober.Coffee weekly on all podcast platforms and check us out on Instagram at Sober.Coffee Podcast and on Twitter at Sober Coffee Pod. To learn more about us and to help support these sessions, visit online at Sober.Coffee. Here are your hosts, two guys on their own path of recovery, Mike and Glenn. Let's join them at the coffee shop.
Good morning, Mr. Glenn.
Hey, what's up, my brother? How you doing?
Good. How you doing?
Good, man. Good seeing you. I always love jumping in the coffee shop with you.
Coffee shop's a safe place to be.
I know, man. We have a very exciting little round table today.
Yeah, we do.
I'm looking forward to it. You know. Here's what it reminds me of. Facebook, and Facebook's 100% true, right?
Of course, if you see it on Facebook, do it, right? Just book it as fast.
So I actually saw this. It was like a traffic sign posted on Facebook. It said, feelings are facts. Act on them.
Oh, there's sound advice for you.
And I'm like, dude, that's like what I did for 50 years, right? And look where it got me, right?
Oh, my goodness.
So we're going to touch on some emotions and feelings and stuff like that today. And I'm usually educated on a topic, and right? But I am here to learn today. Yeah, so I'm excited. I'm excited to, jump in the coffee shop here with you.
Boy, well, now see, there's the contradictory in the terms because I know it all, Glenn.
Yes, you do.
You know,
that's why, you know what? I always get in the room with smarter people, and that's why I'm always in the room with you.
Well, let me tell you something. Don't be too quick to follow me.
Always in the room with you.
Don't be too quick to follow me. No, I've got so much to learn, and I was obviously being sarcastic there because, for years I didn't learn. For years I just kind of went through the motions and kind of let life throw at me what they were going to throw at me. And then kind of drift. I'd for lack of a better term, I was sleepwalking.
Yep. Drunk walking.
Just drunk walking. And to be enlightened and awakened now, every day is just a new pinch me moment for me because I wake up and I'm like, what am I going to learn? What is going to be thrown at me today that I'm going to learn? And almost every day, every day a new circumstance crosses my path that I've got to process, deal with, and react to in a responsible way. And, I didn't do that for years. It's a blessing to be able to do it today. A blessing to be able to do it today.
That's awesome.
So, hey, can I introduce our guest?
Absolutely. Can I wait?
So I'm going to do it in two ways here, and this is a little not typical, but we have with us in our coffee shop, Dr. Alan Berger. Good morning, Dr. Alan Berger. How are you?
Morning, doctor.
Well, good morning, gentlemen. I've got my cup of coffee. And
doctor's
been,
in the house.
Yeah,
you got been eager to join you guys.
No, you're not tipping. You're not tipping back some decafs, are you?
I'm not. No decaf here, baby. This is Italian toast. This is Italian.
Look at that, man. Good stuff.
Oh, you're going high end on us there. You're going high end.
Thanks for joining us, doctor.
Yeah. So, Alan is the author of 12 Essential Insights for Emotional Sobriety: Getting Your Recovery Unstuck. And so when I was about a year and a half, maybe 2 years to recover, it's funny because
and you have five plus years now.
About 5+ years now. So there comes a time in recovery where you're kind of like, what's next? I mean, the beauty of the, and I went the 12-step route, right? For those that don't know, but I went the 12-step route. So I came to my knees, not physically, but figuratively to my knees. And I said, I need help on October 13th, 2018. Help came my way in the shape of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I focused on those steps diligently for the next 18 months. And that filled me. It filled me. But then at about the 18th month point, I said, okay, I got a taste of this, but what's next? And it's funny, when you start listening at the rooms, when you're at these different levels and you're in these meetings, and all of a sudden the term emotional sobriety kept coming up. And I'm like, okay, well, whatever. Now, maybe it had come up for 18 months in a row. I just never paid attention to it. All of a sudden, I'm paying attention to it. I'm like, what's that? My sponsor said, you've got to read this book. The book was 12 Essential Insights for Emotional Sobriety, Getting Your Recovery Unstuck by Alan Berger, PhD. I'm like, okay, giddy up. I'll read the book. Well, the book was life-changing for me because, and I don't use that term lightly, it was, it helped me with what's next. It helped me with what's next. I was stuck in my recovery in that I had done the 12 steps, where's the 13th step? Give me more something to do here.
There's many people who know the 13th step.
Yeah, okay. All right, don't go there.
They know it in a very different way, don't they?
That's right. Yeah. Totally. All right, I meant the 14th step. All right.
There you go.
There you go. That's the one hardly anybody gets to.
That's right.
But I couldn't do the book any better justice than just reading a portion of the foreword to this edition that I have in front of me right now, and I think it's a good investment of 30 seconds to listen it through. So, the 12 Essential Insights for Emotional Sobriety is written by renowned psychotherapist Dr. Alan Berger. In what will become a definitive work on emotional sobriety, he attempts to place the heart inside the mind, free reality from illusion, and associate recovery with the pilgrimage of truth and emotional freedom. Dr. Berger has changed the lives of hundreds of thousands of individuals with his work on emotional sobriety, paving the new path to recovery for both the addict and their families. His tireless work and contributions have been long acknowledged and revered by fellow professionals and he's getting a big head right now, and recovery community. Mm-hmm. Most importantly, he has created a large following among truth seekers. I was one of those, Glenn, and patients alike due to his innovative approach to life, therapy, sobriety, and recovery. In what is the fifth edition of Dr. Berger's 12 Steps of Popular Recovery books, he will take you on an incredible personal journey that will introduce you to the process that will lead to incorporating emotional sobriety into your life and into your recovery. So what is emotional sobriety? I'll finish up here. Emotional sobriety is emotional freedom, a true independence of spirit. It is the transcendence of validated self-esteem and self-validated self-esteem. It is the evolution from emotional dependencies to self-support. That's just part of the foreword. The book has changed hundreds of thousands of lives. It's a great read. I'm hoping, Alan, that at the end of this session, people say, if they haven't bought the book, I hope they go buy the book and most importantly, do the work. It's not a novel. It's a workbook. So thank you for writing it, and thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you so much. And God, I'm so touched, you know, as you share, you know, that with me and looking back at my journey. You know, this last year I celebrated 52 years in recovery.
Wow, that's amazing. That's great.
It is incredible. Did you ever think you'd make it 5.2 days in recovery when you first started your journey?
Of course not.
Yeah.
I had no vision, you know, at that point in time. My consciousness was so limited and so bound by so many issues that I wasn't facing and dealing with.
Right.
And it's been an incredible journey. You know, I think that was my dear friend Herb that wrote that foreword for me on the book.
Okay. Yeah.
He and I have been on this journey for quite some time now together. And it's really true, you know, that there's a few ways to capture it. Maybe we could do this real quick in terms of what is emotional sobriety? Because I get that question asked all the time, and it's hard to say that it's one thing because it's got so many different dimensions and textures to it. But let's see if we can capture the essence, right? The spirit of what that is about. And I oftentimes use this idea. I say that emotional sobriety is a shift in consciousness. And that shift goes from an I'm okay if consciousness, a consciousness that is so dependent on things being a certain way, right?
Right.
On things happening the way that I want them to happen, to a consciousness that says I'm okay even if. That my okay does not depend on what is happening to me. It depends on how I'm coping with and dealing with what is happening to me.
Hmm.
It depends on my relationship to what is happening to me, not on what is happening. And if you think about it, what I'm saying is where are we putting our emotional center of gravity?
Right.
You see, when I put my emotional center of gravity, when I put the locus of that emotional center of gravity outside myself, then I'm very dependent on what's going on around me for me to be okay.
Sure, sure.
know, if you do what I want you to do, I'm having a great day.
Yeah, right. If I think you like me, things are good.
Bill called it, I love that term Bill used in his letter. He called it top approval.
Yeah, right. There you go.
Top approval. Everybody's got to like me for me to be okay. He called those kinds of ideas an impossible way of life.
Right. Yep.
And they do. They create an impossible way of life. Not everybody's going to like me.
I know.
But if my self-esteem is dependent on you liking me, I have to have everybody like me.
Right. And that's improbable. Let's say impossible.
It's impossible. It's just an amazing. And look, I had a lot of ideas like this that made it impossible to show up in life in a good way.
Right.
It was always, it always felt like I was in conflict with life, right. That I was swimming against the stream, and not in a good way. I'm all for challenging things and being iconoclastic when it's appropriate. But this demanding that life do what I wanted it to do caused so many serious problems. And you know, it really did. It is, to me, the one thing that I did in addition to my drinking and using that kept me so damn immature.
Right. So I heard the word expectation in there early. So,
oh, yes.
So it's the management, yes, of expectations is one of the things that jumped out at me.
Big time.
Yes.
Yep. And that's the other thing is, see, the more emotional sobriety I have, the fewer expectations I have. See, the expectations that I become aware of this is my expectations were kind of a scaffolding that I created to make life okay.
Right.
So I set up all of these rules, these unenforceable rules, and if everything went along with them, I thought that that was the path to being okay, to living a good life. But what I realized today, it's letting go. It's not having those expectations. It's letting go of a lot of those expectations and trying to replace them with a set of ideas that are what I would call enhanced life rather than diminished life. You see, that the emotional dependency I had really diminished my possibilities, in my relationships, diminished my possibilities to cope better with life. Now, with emotional sobriety, there's a whole new set of ideas and concepts that are very much rooted in the 12 steps. I mean, look, the good news here is, for those of you that are working the 12 steps, Bill explicitly stated that the goal of working the steps is the achievement, the discovery of emotional sobriety. That's the bottom line. Now, I've been to, trust me, a lot of meetings in 52 years.
Uh-huh.
You know how many times I've heard that in a meeting? Maybe a dozen times. Mm, right. Maybe a dozen times.
Why do you think we're missing that point?
You know, it's that's such a great question to take into meditation and to reflect and ponder on. I've been doing some of it. I think one of the things that happened is that, you know, emotional sobriety is a bit messy because you got to deal with some of these issues that you've been avoiding in your life in terms of growing up. I mean, there's things that, you know, the way I say it to people is when you get into emotional sobriety, only the best in you can see the worst in you. But nobody wants to see the worst in them. You know, we want to always think of ourselves in a positive way. And so, you know, that's where the inventory becomes so important, right? Is taking an honest look at ourselves. Well, how many of us have taken an honest look at ourselves in our life? Not many of us. I mean, I wasn't great at being honest. I'm a lot better at it today after being around for a while. But I look back at that first year, the inventory I took in the first year. It was pitiful, guys.
Yeah.
Right. It was superficial.
Sure. Yeah. You know, I call it the cleaning out the crawl space.
Digging in the dirt.
It's ugly because you got to pull those bins out. You got to open them up. They're all dusty. They got spiders all over them, right? And you're pulling them out and you're like, what's in here? And you'll crack it open. And then it's old pictures. And then the pictures have this emotional tie to them. And then the next box is your one hockey skate. And then you got to sit there and you got to realize that you don't play hockey anymore.
But see, that's one of the things I like about the 12-step program is it forced me. It was a methodology, a path of tearing all that apart. Right. But one of the things that is miracle about AA and my journey in the 12 steps was having a sponsor, right? It's hard to read the label on your own jar, and it's hard to fix a problem with the same brain that created it, right? So having that external, you know, and it's like a lot of sobriety programs out there. I mean, we're certainly pro-sobriety, but some of them are create your own program.
Right.
Well, I did that for 50 years, and look where it got me, right? So, you know, that's where I think having a methodology, a path, but, you know, Alan, you're right. People don't like to pull out that mirror, you know, and look at their hemorrhoids. They just don't, you know. But, you know, and I the Peter Gabriel song, Digging in the Dirt, right? Find the places I was hurt, you know, find out what I'm about. That's where the true growth starts, I think.
Right.
You know, let me say something about what makes that hard to pull out that mirror and look at ourselves. See, it's this idea. So we go back to these expectations that I am supposed to be a certain way to be okay. And when I see these things about myself, the mistakes I've made, you know, I don't like to call them shortcomings or character defects. I call them character defaults. When I see these character defaults that I have in my behavior that have developed, there's a part of me that wants to judge me for those things. And when I'm judging myself for those things, it makes it very hard to look at them because I start hating myself. And I start putting this trip on myself like I'm supposed to be somebody other than I am. And the one thing I know about recovery, regardless of what program you're working, acceptance is a prerequisite to change. Yep. Change does not occur without acceptance. And what we say, the change is paradoxical. And you guys have experienced this. When I admitted I was powerless, I found power. Well, how the hell does that work, right? When I own who I am and I take full responsibility, then I have the possibility of becoming something else, but not when I jump over it. And so back to your statement about what happened, I think we took a spiritual bypass in recovery. I think that instead of getting down and doing this nitty-gritty work, that I think we, and I'm not against this in any way, so please, if you're listening to this podcast, I'm not saying don't turn it over, because I think turning it over does a lot of good things when you turn something over to God. But when we turn it over, it doesn't mean that we abdicate and become passive, that we turn it over to get into that space, into that gap between the problem and our and our reaction to it, so that we can discover, right, some kind of a new possibility in terms of coping with it. So that to me is where turning it over becomes of value, because it creates that opportunity to get in that gap and use that gap in a constructive way instead of just being reactive. When I'm reactive, there's no chance for me being creative and solving a problem or anything.
No way.
So, you know, the worst of me is going to be speaking for the rest of me, not the best of me.
Yeah. So it just hit me about expectations. So for, you know, when I think of the word expectations, and when I, because I manage expectations very closely in my life, and I have found the closer to zero I get, the more peace I have, right? But I'm thinking of expectations of others, right? Yes. What you just brought to light, Alan, is, and I'm not going to have the answer now. I need to really think, you know, process this through. But what are my own expectations for myself, right?
Yes.
Because, I mean, literally, when you use the word expectations, 100% of the time, I'm thinking about my expectations for Mikey, for my family, for my, you know, business life, you know. And if I expect a lot, I'm always disappointed, and then I get resentful, you know, blah, 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 right? But what about internal? That's one of my key takeaways here. And then I love what we said about own who we are. So for 50 years, and I'm 60, so for 50 of the 60 years, you know, I was a chameleon. I would go into a room, and Alan, I would get on this podcast, and I would prejudge who I think you would want me to be and what you expect of me, and I would change, and be, you know, I would operate in that way. And I would go to 12 different situations through the day. I was never me. I was always somebody, something else. And what I've learned in sobriety, and maybe it's, you know, delving into emotional sobriety, But I've learned who I am for the most part. I'm still learning. I'm still growing. I'm still figuring stuff out. I haven't arrived. But I know at least baseline who I am. And what I know for a fact, not everybody likes who I am. Not everybody can deal with who I am. And what I'm okay with is, and the way I look at it is, like, I'm like chocolate ice cream. Not everybody likes chocolate ice cream.
Which makes no sense to me.
But chocolate ice cream's awesome.
Right.
But not everybody likes chocolate ice cream. And I've learned to be okay with that. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't have to say, well, I need to change because Mikey doesn't like me or Alan doesn't like me. You know, I don't know. It's freeing living like that.
Well, what you're saying is that what happens for us is that we get to a place, and look, it's a process, right? But we get to a place where we quit taking things like that as a reflection of who we are. And we can just accept that this is who that other person is. They have preferences. They get to have preferences. They get to like a steak or a chicken or whatever they want. I mean, they're living their life.
Tutti Frutti ice cream.
And how is it? See, that's where that dependency comes in, is that instead of just being able to see other people as they are, I wanted them to see me as I wanted them to see me.
Right.
So it was all about me. It was all about me. And see, that's a big thing about emotional sobriety, too, is we get to a place where we get right-sized, right? This, Bill called it that, he said that emotional sobriety was a balance and maturity, right? Real maturity, he called it. And he says, and then he went on to say, humility in relationship with ourselves, with our fellows, and with God, and I would also add just with life. That's how he defined it. So what is the humility? Well, humility is a low focus on ourselves. I like the way Herb Kagan says it, right? But Herb says, he says, we're not the center of the universe. We're just the center of our universe.
Right.
I mean, there you go.
It's a good way to say it. But for me, before it was, I was the center of the universe. Everything was about me. If you had feelings, obviously those feelings were about me. They weren't about you. Mm-hmm. You know, they were about me. So I took everything personally. Emotional sobriety really is about not taking things personally.
Mm. I love that. I love that. You know, one of the things you were talking about, self-acceptance, and I'm going to quote you off of page 165 because it really jumped out at me as I reread this to prepare for this week. And it says, without self-acceptance, there could be no change, no honesty, no physical sobriety, and no emotional sobriety. And when we achieve acceptance, we unleash an incredible force within us. And right. And that is something that you two are talking about right here that really jumps on me. I need to accept myself more. You know, it becomes less about being a person for somebody else, but more importantly, I have to meet my expectations of who I am. I need to self-accept myself and not be so hard on my personal expectations. And as you said to start out, to be okay, even if. You know, even if I make a bad decision, still be okay. Even if, you know, I respond the wrong way, be okay.
You know, I often give the analogy, Mike, that, you know, if we think about our development early on in life, right? Let's just take the acquisition of walking, mm-hmm. right, as an infant, right? Around 1 year old, now, a child wants to ambulate. They want to get mobile. Now, it's going to happen someday. I know it is. I usually say, no parent has to tell a child it's time to get walking. Get off those quick crawling around the house now. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm sick and tired of this stuff. And start pulling yourself up on the coffee table and learn how to walk. You don't have to do that. And why is it? Because there's something inside of us that makes us move towards what we can be. See, that's the force that's unleashed here in recovery. You know, I often hear that line. You said it earlier, you know, listen, our best thinking got us here. Well, we can look at that from two points of view. One is we can look at it from more of a negative point of view. Yeah, look at, man, some of my ideas about life create an impossible way of life. But the other side of it is there's a part of us that wanted something different and we didn't know how to create it.
Right.
No, part of us that wanted it.
No, exactly. And that's a great way to look at it. There was I probably don't look at it as a cognitive thought. I got to the point of surrender where I had no other choice.
Right.
You know, and maybe it was the thinking that, hey, of understanding, accepting that I had no other choice. I'm like, you know, I got to the point where I said, I will do whatever you tell me to do. I cannot do this.
Right.
No, you were defeated. You were defeated. And
yeah, that's a great word.
Recovery is based upon a bedrock of hopelessness, mm-hmm. and which is a weird thing to say because, you know, you talk to most psychologists, they don't want a client to feel hopeless. Well, I do.
Mm-hmm.
I want you to feel hopeless because then you're in a place where you now have new possibilities that you can discover. But go back to the analogy of walking. So that desire to walk is innate.
Right.
That is part of who you are, part of who I am. Our growth force, whatever you call it, it's what makes us want to move to next, Mike.
Right.
You talk about moving to next. That's the force that moves you from now to next.
Right.
Now, for a child, that when we think about it, because they don't have other parts of their brain developed, thank God, or else we would have never walked. You know, they get up, they pull themselves up on a coffee table, they let go, and what happens? They fall.
They fall down.
Because they don't know
right.
how to navigate. They don't know how to navigate. Gravity, right? They've got to learn how to tense certain muscles, relax certain muscles, stand in this three-dimensional plane. After they figure that out, after making a lot of mistakes, they take their first step. And what do? They fall.
Right.
How many times do they fall before they master that skill of walking? Well, as many as they need to. See, there's no rule in their head, expectation, back to what you said. They don't have an expectation.
Right.
You got 20 times to figure this walking out.
Yep.
If you make 20 mistakes and you don't make it, buddy, get back on your all fours and start growling. Right. Thank God we don't have that in our head.
Right.
See, that's a should. You see what I mean? That's a should. Those shoulds come into play later on in life. And when they do, they interfere with this organismic wisdom. So the child doesn't have it. They'll fall as many times as they need to, and eventually they'll learn to walk. Because every time they fail, that experience gets processed at a subconscious, unconscious level in the brain, and the brain starts to compute all of this data and figures out what it has to do to be successful next time around.
So let me jump in with that metaphor. And say, we hear a lot of times, relapse is part of recovery, right?
Wow.
And I, you know what? I relapsed so many times. And Alan, just a quick snippet. You know, I've been in over 80 hospitalizations, detoxes.
Glenn's an overachiever.
Yeah, you know, I was going for the goal.
Yeah.
And
80.
Yeah.
80.
80.
I
yes.
stopped counting around 75 or 80. I mean, it's well over that. I mean, I was six different hospitals across the country in 1 week.
Yeah.
And then an 8-day detox. So there's seven right there.
Like I said, Glenn is definitely an overachiever.
Right. So I was on the relapse path. And hey, when I came back to the room after relapse, I wanted to be coddled. I wanted, hey, Glenn, it's all right, man. Come on in. You know, and so much on social media, you know, it talks about relapse, coddling, right? And it's, hey, it's part of the journey. But Mikey and I have gone to funerals where people have relapsed and they've never made it. So I look at more of a fire alarm. But as you make the metaphor, the child crawling and standing up and then falling, right? I have a lot of data from my relapses, right? And I'm not sure. I mean, I had a bunch of doctors trying to do stuff with that data and right? I mean, the end game was I had to surrender and go to AA and do everything I was told in AA, and that's where I finally saw some progress and saw some facts, right? But somewhere, I got a lot of data from a lot of those relapses,
mm-hmm.
you know?
You did.
And the one big piece of data is there isn't anything I can do in my brain. There's nothing out there where I can go back and safely drink today.
Right.
That's the concrete piece of data that I finally, from all my falls, from my weeble and wobble and falls, I have figured out. So somewhere there's a connection.
And what ideas did you have to give up about yourself to finally accept that?
I was not God.
See, that's what I mean. See, that was the impediment, if you will. That was the block that prevented you from metabolizing or assimilating what you were learning through your experience. When you had this idea, I have to be this way to be okay, meaning I can't be powerless. If you're powerless, that's not a path to okay. Mm-hmm. That means I'm going to be a failure. That means I'm going to be a loser, or whatever in your head that was. You see, it made it impossible for you to accept that. But as soon as you got to the point where you could let that go and say, you know what? That doesn't define me. What defines me is what I do with this reality of myself that I'm powerless.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So another way of defining emotional sobriety is it's an honest and appropriate relationship to reality.
Mm-hmm. I love it. So two things. Number one, I'm unfortunately the time master, but I think this has been a great start. And here's my analogy. I'd love for you to come back next week, because I think today we talked a little bit about walking, a little bit about crawling, actually, and pulling up and walking. The book, okay, and this is just one resource that's available if people want to explore emotional sobriety. The book pulls out and talks about 12 essential insights for emotional sobriety. I mean, there is a solution, as Glenn loves to say. There is a solution, and there's a solution to recovery, and there is a path to emotional sobriety. Will you come back on next week and talk more about that?
I would love to.
That'd be great.
As long as you guys got some coffee waiting.
Oh, we always have coffee waiting for you. All right, that's awesome. Sounds good. Let's regroup next week. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us for today's Coffee Chat. To contact the show, email us at podcast@sober.coffee. If you need immediate help, the AA hotline is 800-839-1686. The National Suicide Prevention Hotline is 800-273-8255. Remember, Mike and Glenn are sharing their own journey on the path to recovery. Any suggestions, medical or otherwise, are their own experiences and should not be viewed as professional advice. See you next week, and remember, there is a solution.